the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Members present, Representative Tuck, Representative Johansson, Representative Edgman, Representative Peterson, and myself, Representative Millet. We are here to take up bills previously heard. The bill we will be taking up today, and just for information, for Thursday will be House Bill 182. Before us, we have a CS that has not been adopted yet. It's Work Draft 26-GH1041/S, Chenoweth Bailey. That will be our working document for today. We finished last meeting with Brian Bjorkquist from Department of Law walking us through the bill, and I think, Brian, if you'd like to take a seat and put yourself on the record, I think we are at Section 3 of the bill. Chapter 50, page 3, line 15 is where we left off, and
yes,
we'll continue that.
For the record, I am Brian Bjorkquist. I'm a senior assistant attorney general for the state of Alaska. We were on Section 6 of the bill, page 3, line 14. I'm just going to continue going through the bill. Again, I'm going to hit some of the high points. If anybody has any questions, I'm happy to answer them, but try to get it through it relatively high level, section by section. Starting on line 16 of page 3, this is the section that deals with formation of an energy and transmission corporation. It requires four or more municipal or cooperative public utilities. It also requires that they first be authorized by law to form, which would require other legislation. In this bill, Section 13 provides for that authorization by law for the Gretzky Corporation to be formed.
And Brian, just I'm going to stop you real quick. Let the record reflect that Representative Dahlstrom has joined us, and it is 3:07. And Brian, on that Section 13 of this bill, that's the enabling legislation that allows Gretzky to form?
That's correct. On page 21, Section 13, it's an uncodified law titled Authorization to Form Greater Rail Belt Energy and Transmission Corporation. And I'll just jump to that. The first section authorizes the formation of the Gretzky Corporation under 4250. If four or more of the listed utilities, by four or more of the listed utilities. Subsection B provides a contingency. The corporation has to agree to conduct, under the direction of legislative budget and audit, a management audit of the corporation 3 years. 3 years out, 6 years out, and 10 years out. And then gives details for the criteria for that management audit. Then Section 14, that provides a conditional effective date for most of the bill, and under proposed amendments, it would include Section 13 of the bill. Under that section, the utilities listed in Section 13, if four or more of them deliver to the Alaska Energy Authority a letter of intent in form and substance acceptable to the Alaska Energy Authority by July 30, 2010, then the effective date becomes effective and the authorization to form the corporation takes effect. That's located on page 22, lines 10 through 17. Going back to page 3 and section 6 of the bill, the authorization to form, the general purposes are also listed in this section 010. Under lines 20 through 25, there are two purposes for the formation. One is to acquire, operate, or maintain a power or transmission project from the Alaska Energy Authority. Second is, subsection 2, is to plan for, recommend, coordinate, and otherwise address generation and transmission needs for the service territory of the corporation. And in the last hearing, I discussed the criticalness of that and how this is tied to, for example, replacing some of the void that will be caused by the Alaska Intertie Agreement terminating this next October, plus that agreement only being signed by some, not all of the rail belt utilities.
And Brian, can I stop you? Can you explain to me and the committee members how this, these two structures are different from the Joint Action Authority, joint, what is it, the JAA?
Madam Chair, I can.
Okay.
If you look at the two items, one and two, the first one dealing with a project of the Alaska Energy Authority, that basically is what a JAA is about. If you look at the Joint Action Agency Statute 42, 45, 310, everything is about acquiring an energy project from the Alaska Energy Authority. That legislation was enacted to assist in the divestiture of the Four Dam Pool project. And so everything in that legislation is aimed at that. This legislation adds to that purpose, to plan for the electrically interconnected service territory of the corporation. It has a greater public function. And the reason for the difference is you can see from a practical standpoint. The Four Dam Pool, they were four completely isolated projects at the time of the divestiture. None of them were connected to each other. Now, the two southeast projects, Swan Lake and Lake Tyee, were just connected to each other through the transmission line that was completed this last winter. But at the time, there was no connection between any of the projects. And so the legislation only focused on the acquisition of the projects. And the legislation, the Joint Action Agency legislation, is similar to this bill also in that it also required approval by law before the JAA could be formed with the powers under 310 and 320. Under 42, 45, 310A, the legislature has to first approve the acquisition of one of the Alaska Energy Authority projects before the formation under those sections with the powers under sections 310 and 320 would be effective. For clarity, there's another type of joint action agency, and that's one that's formed under 42, 45, 300. That basically is just a joint venture between two or more public utilities to deal with a project or a number of projects. But it doesn't have any of the powers that are found in 310 and 320. And those are the powers that you might look at this bill and see that there's some similarities between the two.
So under 42, 45, 310, acquisition of power projects under the Joint Action Agency statute, they're very similar, except that the Joint Action Agency may request through ADA to issue revenue bonds. And so what we're doing under GRETC is having, can you tell me how that's different? I mean, you're saying that they're still owning assets, they're still Joint Action Agency still allows them to design, construct, operate, maintain transmission and generation facilities, and carry out design. And then they still can request from the state of Alaska, you know, money, revenue, whether it's in the form of a bond or a form of a GF appropriation. And then when you go down to 42, 45, 310, the language seems incredibly similar to what we're trying to do here. Without the inclusion of the IRP, I mean, I guess I'm not noticing the big differences that you're showing me, other than in this bill, we're allowing them to own fuel storage, fuel resources, leases, land, own pipelines, limit the ability of independent power producers to join in because of transmission connectivity. So sounds like the GRETC legislation is a little more encumbering than the Joint Action Agency would be. So are we narrowing it down so this is the, I mean, why wouldn't we form under JAA?
Again, let me just, Madam Chair, let me just clarify that you hit on part of it. That the GRETC this Energy and Transmission Corporation legislation, it also deals with issues dealing with interconnected electrically interconnected utilities. The planning, the regional planning functions that GRETC is obligated to do, including the integrated resource plan, the long-range fuel supply plan, the long-range capital improvement plan, the long-range financial management plan, all of those regional planning functions are an important add-on that is not part of the JAA legislation or statutory scheme. Again, that the JAA legislation was set up to assist in the divestiture of the four-dam pool for isolated hydroelectric projects. And so there was no need for regional planning because there wasn't a region for any planning to happen. There was no electric interconnection between any of those at the time of the divestiture. This is an important component of this legislation because it's going to provide for regional planning of future generation and transmission needs for, under the GRETC formation of a corporation, the rail belt. And this is an important function that this provides that the JAA statute and the concept under the JAA statute did not provide for.
Does it prohibit it? Couldn't the Joint Action Agency adopt an IRP, and couldn't they adopt those things under the JAA? I guess what I'm saying is the statute really needed, or couldn't they do all these things themselves under forming that Joint Action Agency with a memorandum of understanding between the agencies that they would work off of an IRP?
Madam Chair, this statute, HB 182, requires, it mandates that all of this be done. And so it requires, and you know that the utilities are going to be doing this regional planning. Now, without it, you're in the situation where you're in right now. All the utilities could elect to plan on a regional basis, but for whatever reason, that hasn't happened, you know, globally throughout the rail belt is the history. There's been some joint planning, but not comprehensive. This bill requires it in a number of ways.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you. just two things on that point. I think we could probably do an IRP anytime we wanted to. We don't need to be required by statute to do it. I mean, AEA could do it. The governor could do it. Legislature could make a specific appropriation and demand that it be done. So I don't necessarily see the need for it in the bill, but that's beside the point. Is there, going back to joint action agencies, you mentioned the JAA that was put together specifically for divestiture of the four-dam pool. Is there another joint action agency currently legally in place right now in the state?
I am not aware of another joint action agency that is operating. I know that there has been effort by some of the rail belt utilities to form a joint action agency. My understanding is that was done in anticipation of divestiture of Bradley Lake and the Alaska Intertie. But to my knowledge, it is not functioning, operating, as it were.
Brian, there was one formed July 26, 2005. It was called AREA, and it was the Municipal Light and Power. It was the Fairbanks Golden Valley Electric Association that came together under JAA. It's still in existence. It's not utilized right now, but they did form that, and I believe Chugach signed in on a later date after July. But basically, the AREA was formed for exactly what we're doing with GRETC, and I'm not sure. I'll ask Chugach and GVA and MLP when they come to testify why that they're not using that and why that model failed, and how this GRETC bill will strengthen what they failed to do on their own, and why we need enabling legislation to make them come to the table and be one giant co-op. So,
and Madam Chair, that is the joint action agency I was referencing. You have the name of it there.
Any other questions while we're right here? Okay, thanks, Brian. Keep going.
Back to page 3, starting on line 26, there are a listing of other purposes of the corporation. Line 30, it's to be the primary recipient of state financial assistance. This is a provision that is the rail belt utilities who would be forming GRETC. This is the a response to statements that have been made over the last decade that there is a desire for the rail belt utilities to coordinate, consolidate before there would be availability of rail belt energy funds. And so this is a statement of purpose that this entity is being formed for that purpose.
I'm sorry, Brian. So the reason that they're forming GRETC is so that they can have access to the rail belt energy fund?
Madam Chair, yes. And in addition to that, other state financial assistance. The reference to the Rail Belt Energy Fund reflects statements that have been made over the last decade about use of that particular fund, but there are other state financial assistance that would be anticipated as well.
Okay.
On page 4, starting on line 3, subsection C, there are a number of more specific types of planning that this corporation would be providing, from adequacy of fuel supply, adequacy of generation and transmission assets, down to diversity in generation resources, renewable energy-based generation, renewable energy generation resources, and integration of those into the system. On line 19.
Brian, can I just stop you? Can you just explain to me what diversity in generation resources means?
Madam Chair, diversity means that you're having, for example, different fuel supplies. Rather than having all the energy generation from oil or gas, that you would diversify the energy portfolio.
So GRETC would own different types of fuel supply, or would they own a renewable energy project? Would they own, I mean, what does this encompass? What are we giving them authority to own?
Madam Chair, under this section, this is for the planning and making recommendations. The diversity in generation resources would be focused more on the generating assets that would use various types of fuels. This is not specifically aimed at any type of fuel that the corporation would be acquiring, other than whatever type of generation asset would be acquired or operated or become part of the corporation. Obviously, they would have to obtain fuel for that particular type of generating asset.
And then in section 425009, under general powers of the corporation, that's where we give them the authority to own, manufacture, purchase, acquire, accumulate, transmit, meter, dispatch energy. Procure fuel supplies, fuel storage, fuel transmission.
There are a number of powers in that section. Yes, Madam Chair.
So okay. I'll wait until we get to that section before asking my questions. Thanks, Brian. You're very patient.
Page 4, line 19. This clarifies that the corporation will operate on a nonprofit basis. It also provides that it will offer its services based on uniform rates for like services under standard tariffs or contractual arrangements. And the one thing I want to clarify here, this is not a postage stamp rate. A uniform rate is not necessarily a postage stamp rate. It arguably could be, but there are differences in the cost of providing services to various customers, and those might be reflected in a rate based on uniform rates for like services. And if the services are different, then obviously the rates could be different. Under page 4, line 26 and 27, there's a statement of the exercise of the corporation being for a public purpose, and that ties in with the public services that this corporation will deal with regional planning and providing for some of those regional type services. Moving on to page 5.
Brian, can you go through section G, line 28? I've had a lot of people ask me questions about the corporation and its interconnection policy, and since we don't have any transmission standards within the state of Alaska, they'll be making up their own standards for interconnection, and I think it gives great pause to a lot of renewable energy projects that are coming online the wind farm, the Mount Spur project, of not knowing what the corporation is going to adopt as interconnection standards, and that they might be adopting standards that the threshold for IPPs to meet will never be met, and basically excluding any type of renewable project to come into the GRETC grid.
Yes. Madam Chair, if you look at page 18, lines 7 through 9, this is the what gives should give comfort to others who would want to be make sure that they can participate in on the transmission system. This gives RCA jurisdiction over joint use and interconnection of facilities, which would include the transmission facilities and services. Section 8, which is this is a part of, would become effective in 2015. Prior to that time, under this bill, the corporation will be subject to regulation by RCA, so this provision would apply anyway. So it's going to apply forever. This is just a recognition that this provision will apply after the GRETC is no longer regulated by the RCA. What this provision does is it allows RCA to order there to be joint use and interconnection. They can order the GRETC Corporation to allow an IPP to put power onto the transmission system. The RCA can order the terms and conditions of that. And so this provision here demonstrates that the GRETC Corporation can't close off the system, close off the rail belt to others. RCA can step in and order that to happen.
For the first 5 years?
Throughout the time. This provision, Section 8, becomes effective in 2015. This is to make very clear that the corporation will be subject to that jurisdiction even after it ceases to be otherwise subject to RCA regulation in 2015. Prior to this time, it will be subject to RCA regulation. This is a component part of that regulation. So it will be initially and beyond 5 years.
So then why would we need Section G if it's already taken care of through the RCA? Why would the corporation, if the RCA is going to regulate that interconnection, why is there a specific section in here that has the corporation adopting its own interconnection criteria?
Madam Chair, there has to be a starting point as to what the rules for interconnection are, and that's what the provision in subsection G does. It allows the GRETC Corporation to start with establishing what the terms and conditions for interconnection and establish standards. And then so that will be the base provision. Now, if you know somebody wants to use it and they don't like the standards, they can go to RCA under the joint use and interconnection, and RCA can arbitrate those types of disputes.
So are those interconnection standards, are they the same for each six of the utilities that we have currently? Are they different, or do they all have the same interconnection standards currently?
Currently, there is just one interconnection standard throughout the rail belt, and this is the standard that each of the utilities are required, or they voluntarily follow what the standards are. Currently, it basically is part of the Alaska Intertie Agreement. The utilities have been working cooperatively to come up with new standards to modernize those standards, and one of the utilities would be better able to explain where in the process they're at. But there's every expectation that what has been developed by the utilities cooperatively will evolve into what this standard under this particular provision would be. So you'd have interconnection standards that would be set by the corporation as the starting point again.
And then I don't mean to monopolize all the questions, but and then does the RCA approve those standards, or are those just the standards that the corporation have? And if someone doesn't get in based on those standards, the only relief that they have to get in is to go and open a docket with the RCA or sue?
Madam Chair, I don't know whether the contemplation is that the utilities will take the standards to the RCA to have them approved. I've heard the possibility of that, but I don't know whether that is part of the plan at this point. And going back to the joint use and interconnection, the process that's required is the statute first requires the utilities to negotiate with each other. If they fail to be successful in negotiating, then they can bring it to the RCA. The RCA would open a docket and deal with the issues at that point in time.
Okay. Is there any questions? Thanks, Brian.
Page 5. Line 2, Board of Directors. The Board of Directors is basically going to have two representative directors from each of the public utility members of the corporation and one public director appointed by the governor from a list of at least three people supplied by the utility representative directors on the board. There are also many provisions for the operation of the board. Page 5, line 30, board meetings and exceptions. There are provisions dealing with board meetings and how they will operate, provisions for executive sessions, the type of topics that can be in executive session. Page 7, line 6, 4250.040, officers and employees, just establishes the methodology by which the corporation will hire their employees. Page 7, line 17, membership. A couple of points here. There are two different, I believe I testified about this on last week, but there are two different types of members. Public utility members who will have representative directors on the board, and then there's also provision for other members, entities that acquire services or power from the corporation. And the other members could include public utilities that either choose not to be public utility members or that don't qualify. For a public utility to qualify as a public utility member, it must either be a municipality or a cooperative.
This Brian, can I stop you for a second? Can we go back up to officers and employees? I just need a little clarification. The chief executive officer that the board appoints, is it from that group of utility board members, or is it someone outside of the board?
Madam Chair, it has to be somebody outside of the board. On line, page 7, line 7, the chief executive officer may not be a director and serves at the pleasure of the board.
Okay, and Brian, is there a reason why we don't have this specified on who can be the chief executive of a utility corporation? We don't have it specified like under AOGCC and some other boards that we have criteria laid out. They either need to be an engineer, they need to be an attorney, they need to be a financial officer, or we don't have any specificity in this section on it could just, I mean, Frankie, you could do this, or...
Madam Chair, I don't think I could, but...
What I'm saying is we don't have any criteria for who the chief executive officer is, so is there a reason why we don't have someone specific in mind, someone with 10 years of utility experience or 10 years of
Madam Chair,
specific...
Madam Chair, I don't know what the answer to that is in the formation, but I would venture a guess that because the directors are going to be dominated by the public utilities, 12 of 13 if all six form, the utilities are going to pick somebody who is capable of doing that. That would be what I would I think the answer to your question is. It's not a situation where unsophisticated directors are going to be selecting who the CEO should be. And I think there is a desire not to have more specific criteria with that understanding that you're going to have sophisticated directors directly from the six rail belt utilities.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on this CEO, the CEO could be a member that's a non-voting member. I mean, it could be from a non-voting member utility. But just not on the board of directors.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, correct. It just the person just cannot be a director of the corporation. It could be a person who works for one of the utilities, public utilities, or a member. It just cannot be a person who is a director.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Did you have a question, Representative Edmund?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I was just sitting here thinking about the not-for-profit status of the corporation and how large the entity certainly could be over time and would be starting out, but just sitting here wondering or thinking whether the bill itself has been scrutinized by somebody who's an expert in tax law, for example, knowing that the not-for-profit status of this corporation may at some point down the road come at a challenge.
Mr. Co-Chair, that is a topic that has not been vetted through experts yet, but that is one of the topics that the utilities understand needs to be done in part of the organization of this entity. There are probably going to be some tax issues. This is basically a generation and transmission cooperative. Under IRS rulings, there are certain criteria that must be met. And when the utilities organize, they're going to have to go through and make sure that they, in organizing in the bylaws, that they meet all of those criteria to meet tax-exempt status.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Brian.
Going back to the membership section, one change from the original bill is that members can be added and may withdraw after the initial creation of the corporation. Under the original bill, the utilities were listed and identified as who would be basically a member of the corporation. They had an opportunity to opt out of the corporation before it formed, and if any utility wanted to join or leave the corporation afterwards, that would have required legislation to remove their name from the statute that would have listed them as being a participant in the corporation. There was a desire for flexibility, so this bill allows adding public utility members later, adding members later, and withdrawing both at some point in the future. Page 8, line 21.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you. Brian, on that point, what if half of the members wanted to withdraw?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, if half the members wanted to resign, withdraw, and they met the criteria for withdrawing, they could withdraw. And the natural consequence of that is that you could have a corporation with fewer than, you know, six, fewer than four cooperative members at that point.
Follow-up,
Representative Dahlstrom.
So that would kind of defeat the purpose of what the intent of the bill is, wouldn't it?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, the purpose of the bill, I would suggest, is something different. The purpose of the bill is to give an opportunity for utilities, in particular rail belt utilities, to form an organization, to work cooperatively together, and with every expectation that they will be successful. If successful, they would not be withdrawing. Obviously, if at some point certain utilities found it to be unsuccessful and chose to withdraw, then the goals, you know, of unifying would not be met. But I would suggest that the purpose of the bill is to give every opportunity for the utilities to successfully organize and coordinate together. And I believe the bill satisfies that goal.
Okay. And then one more follow-up.
So
if a utility chose to withdraw for whatever their reasons and they had received compensation, whether it came in the form of funding or intellectual knowledge or, I mean, I can think of a couple other examples that allowed them to benefit, would they be responsible or liable to pay back, or, I mean, can you just stay till the party's done and then leave and not clean up?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, if you look at page 8, line 3, in order for a member or a public utility member to withdraw from the corporation, they first have to pay or provide for the payment of all liabilities owed to the corporation. So if there's any liability owed to the corporation, that has to be paid or some provision for payment has to be made first. Now, if you look down on subsection F, lines 14 through 18, this section would allow a public utility member to withdraw from being a public utility member but remain a member. And the one difference is they don't have to pay off their liabilities. As a continuing member, they would continue to pay their liabilities from within the corporation, and therefore they wouldn't have to pay their liabilities to get out.
In one lump sum? Pay them off in one lump sum?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom. It could either be in a lump sum or provide for the payment of all liabilities. There could be over a period of time or some other type of arrangement. It's a little bit more flexible than having to pay in one lump sum.
All right, just trying to understand. Thank you.
Page 8, line 21, Articles of Incorporation. Because this bill transforms from naming a specific corporation with specific entities to authorizing the formation of a general energy and transmission corporation, the Articles of Incorporation are necessary so that the entity can prove its corporate existence by going to the Department of Commerce and getting a certificate that they exist, and that's often useful in conducting business. Page 9, line 12, there's provision for bylaws. Page 9, line 22, there's provision for indemnification of directors, officers, and employees. Page 9, line 25, there are the general powers of the corporation. The general powers of this corporation are similar to the general powers of an electric cooperative. I'll point out a couple of specific things. On page 10, lines 13 through 21, this is the one place where the corporation has the ability, the power to sell energy power at retail. And it's only to an industrial customer. The industrial customer cannot be in a certificated service territory of a public utility unless the public utility consents in writing to the sale to that industrial customer. So the point is that there's a limitation on which industrial customers this corporation could sell at retail. Again, most of the power sales are going to be at wholesale to individual public utilities is the contemplation. Page 11, line 8, there's the exercise.
Can I stop you there for a second? So the corporation will sell power to basically the existing six distribution utilities. I would imagine that at the beginning there'll still be distribution. Chugach will still distribute power. MEA will still distribute power. MLP will still distribute power. They'll just have a cogeneration agreement. So what about Gretzky? Can it sell itself to an industrial anchor? Or would that distribution have to be through one of the other entities until?
Madam Chair, that provision that I just pointed out would allow a sale to an industrial customer with the caveat that if that industrial customer is in another service territory, that utility that had the service territory would have to consent in writing to the sale. Now, if there is an industrial customer outside of any utility service territory, Gretzky could sell to that industrial customer.
And Madam Chair,
sell power.
Representative Edgman?
And do this as a not-for-profit corporation?
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair, yes.
Okay.
Returning page 11, line 8. The corporation will have the powers of eminent domain, the same powers that a public utility has under public utility statutes, with the exception that the corporation could not exercise that power of eminent domain to take an electric power generation or transmission asset from another public utility. Moving on, page 12, line 15.
Can I stop you? Would I have one quick question? So, not another public utility. They couldn't exercise eminent domain over another public utility. So what about in here? They own gas storage. They can own pipelines, they can own leases, this eminent domain, even if they're not a public utility, let's say a private corporation owns a pipeline, owns a gas storage facility, owns a lease, can they exercise eminent domain over that for the greater good of the public use?
Madam Chair, that's a question I would need to do some research on. I am not an expert in eminent domain, but I would need to do some more research. I think there are there's more to this. First, it would have to be related to the public utility use. And so the question I'm a little bit confused on, I would need to spend some time taking a look at that.
Well, gas storage is the one that I could think of right away that would be for the utility, the better good of the public. I mean, we're going through that situation right now in Anchorage. is if we did have gas storage, I mean, it would, you know, we're working towards getting gas storage, but once we do get gas storage and owned by a third party or private entity, and all of a sudden Gretzky decides it wants to own a, you know, a gas-fired plant that can get on the pipeline service and take over a gas storage facility for the public good instead of having a third-party sales agreement, I guess that would be my question. Could they exercise eminent domain over a gas storage facility that someone has invested millions of dollars in to provide that service, and Gretzky thinks they could provide it better than the private enterprise and cut out the middleman and do it themselves? Would that be something that this corporation could do?
Madam Co-Chair, it is theoretically possible, but the eminent domain requires to pay compensation of the full value.
Right. I'm
and
sorry. Yes.
The full value would include the profitability of the whatever would be taken. And so that's part of what I'm having a little bit of difficulty answering your question more specifically, because it might theoretically be possible, but when you get into the practical details of exercising eminent domain and dealing with what the fair market value of that asset is, including the business prospects that would arise out of that asset by the private owner, it from a practical standpoint off would not make sense to try to take it.
What about a depreciated pipeline that has access to a gas lease that the corporation is developing?
Madam Co-Chair, the accounting value is not the issue when it comes to eminent domain. It's the fair market value. And whether something's been depreciated or not, the value of that is the fair market value as opposed to what the book value might be.
Well, I guess I can tell you one of my hang-ups is we're having a hard time getting people to explore in Cook Inlet now. If we have someone that's state-funded that goes in and explores, ruins the market for a private sector person, they abandon, they have no use for their pipeline, it isn't working, and the exercise eminent domain is caused by the corporation that is investing in oil and gas leases on the state's dime. I mean, it would serve a public purpose because the pipeline wasn't being used. So I guess I'm worried about we're setting up a state-owned oil and gas company to drive, you know, existing oil and gas players of the Cook Inlet out of the market. So just that scenario could happen.
Madam Co-Chair, we may be dealing with a topic that the last set of amendments to the bill tried to address, which is to take out of this corporation the power to do the exploration, et cetera. Many of those provisions have been deleted from this CS. And now, acquisition of fuel supplies, that's something that any utility that has a generating asset needs to participate in. So I think we may be talking about something that, through amendments to the bill, has been removed from the powers of this Energy and Transmission Corporation.
Hey, Representative Johansson.
Are we still under general powers?
Is that?
No, we can go back.
I'm kind of slowing behind here. Page 12, line 9, number 26, create subsidiary corporations. Do those by default follow the limited by the first 25 powers of incorporation of the master corporation? If the Gretzky as a corporation creates a subsidiary corporation, do they by default have to follow the first 25 powers of the overall corporation?
Or can they incorporate and have other powers that I'm not aware of? I have no idea.
Through the co-chair, Representative Johansson, that's a good question. I think the answer is that the Gretzky Corporation can only perform the duties that it has the power to perform, and so it would be limited by those first 25 powers and whatever else is in this bill. It could not, by a subsidiary, expand into some other area. The purpose of the creating a subsidiary corporation is to assist in financing of a project. There may be a situation where for financing a project, having a project within a subsidiary corporation may make some financing sense. But I believe the answer to your question is that Gretzky could not expand into other ventures because it doesn't have the authority to do that under the general corporate powers.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Brian.
Moving on to page 12, line 15. This is the Public Utility Powers and Regulation. For the first 5 years, the corporation will be subject to general regulation by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Item one talks about no retail sales of electric power except to industrial customer under the statutory section we discussed earlier. And the one thing it's not required to do is obtain a certificate under 4205-221. Moving on to sections 7 and 8 of the bill on page 17, carrying over to 18, these are the sections that in 2015 will amend that statutory section to provide for exemption from regulation. And under section 7, there's an amendment to basically what is there in the bulk of the bill, and it adds an exemption from the regulatory cost charge and exempt from rate regulation under 4205-431. Then section 8 adds a new subsection which makes clear that the corporation will first have to comply with certain principles and requirements contained in RCA statutes 4205-441 through 4205-491, as if the corporation were a regulated public utility. Those provisions are basically deal with record keeping and documenting certain things that are important for reviewing rates and making sure that the rates are meet the applicable standard, which in this case will be the same basic RCA standard of just and reasonable rates. Going back to page 12.
Brian, can you point out where the five-year sunset is in this section?
Madam Co-Chair, rather than there being a sunset, I think it's more accurate to say that there's a sunrise of the exemption from rate regulation. If you look on page 23, line 7 and 8, there are a number of sections identified that take effect August 16th, 2015. The contingency mentioned in 14C has to do going back to at least four of the rail belt utilities giving the letter of intent necessary to have all of these substantive provisions take effect. And so the exemption from rate regulation, sunrises is the way I would characterize it in 2015 rather than going the opposite direction.
So that would be Section 16 takes effect in 2015?
Correct, Madam Co-Chair. Going back to page 12, these are the sections that deal with regional planning. And just a couple of points dealing with all these sections basically in combination. These provide some significant potential advantages. The best opportunity to protect ratepayers and consumers' interest often is before money is spent on projects. And in order to make wise decisions before you expend money on projects, planning is an important component. And that's something that rate regulation generally addresses after a project is built. And so forcing and mandating that there be regional planning offers some advantages in that context. The information that would be developed in the regional planning will be effective in several ways. First, it will provide information to the corporation, to members, so that they can make better decisions. Second, ratepayers will have that information so that they can use that information when they deal with their own public utility in addition to dealing with the corporation itself. And perhaps the most important aspect of that is the legislature will have the information. The legislature will have the authority on an ongoing basis to provide oversight over this corporation, what it's doing. Each of the sections dealing with plans requires that they be made available to the legislature, so you'll have the information. And the other thing is that it will help the legislature evaluate funding requests when they come in. And I just want to quickly skip ahead to page 14. Lines 11 through 14, just to point out the financing component. That section, subsection B, deals with many different ways that the corporation may obtain state financial assistance. Two points that need to be made about that. There is nothing in this bill that obligates the state to provide any specific type of financial assistance or any financial assistance whatsoever. Secondly, there's nothing in this legislation that limits the strings that the state can impose on any state financial assistance that's provided. And there is a full expectation that this corporation is going to be obtaining state financial assistance at some point in the future for the major projects that are going to be necessary in the rail belt. But the point is, there's also an expectation that there's going to be negotiation over terms and conditions over what state strings, conditions, terms and conditions the state will impose in order to obtain, for the corporation to obtain the state financial assistance. With the point being is that this bill doesn't answer a whole lot of questions, but it leaves open for future negotiation, what the state financing is going to be and what conditions will be imposed in order to obtain that. And that's an expectation.
Brian, can I ask you a question? Oh, go ahead, Bryce.
Well, I was going to say, by definition, a corporation obviously would tie in the subsidiary corporations in. Is that sort of unspoken?
Mr. Co-Chair, I don't think that is spoken. And I think that if a subsidiary is formed, it would not have any of the powers that the Gretzky Corporation or the Energy and Transmission Corporation would have. For example, if a subsidiary is formed, it would not automatically have the same rules with rate regulation. Now, something could be done someplace else, but a subsidiary would have to stand on its own and can't absorb all of the benefits that are provided in the statute. And if that sounds inconsistent with what I said before, let me try to explain in my attempt to answer Representative Johansson's question. A Gretzky Corporation or an energy and transmission company that forms a subsidiary can't go beyond its powers, but it also can't give powers to a subsidiary formed under another statutory scheme that don't exist under that statutory scheme. So there's a limitation on what it can do and a limitation in the other statutory scheme as to what powers the subsidiary could have.
And then, Brian, I just have a question. Under the joint action agencies, one of the things that they spelled out in that statute is that the joint action agency may request the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority to issue revenue bonds for projects of the agencies. It's not mentioned in here. It doesn't limit them from doing that, but it's not mentioned in Gretzky that ADA can be a bonding source.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Is there a reason why we didn't include that language from the joint action agency into Gretzky?
Madam Co-Chair, with the Four Dam Pool divestiture, there was already an expectation that ADA was going to finance the sale of the Four Dam Pool. AEA's sale of the Alaska Energy Authority's sale of the Four Dam Pool to the Joint Action Agency was going to be done financed by ADA. There was, at that point in time, there wasn't clarity that this new Joint Action Agency would have financial capabilities going forward, so I believe that that is just to, because of the relationship that Ada already had in the financing of the divestiture. But the lack of that statement in the this Energy and Transmission Corporation doesn't preclude anybody from using Ada financing or, frankly, Alaska Energy Authority financing for projects or any other state financing.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johansson.
Maybe the Board of AEA knew what the Board of Ada was thinking.
Point taken. Representative Johansson.
Just moving back to page 12, lines 25 through 30, the Integrated Resource Plan, and also there's similar provisions under in the next page, Long Range Fuel Supply Plan. It requires, both of them require the corporation in developing a the particular plan to consider any state plans, state energy plans, and if they there's a deviation from what the state plan provides, that they have to provide a report explaining the deviations. This provision provides a degree of transparency and political accountability. Again, it's information that can empower ratepayers and the legislature in their oversight and funding. But if the corporation were to deviate from state energy plans, they have to at least explain in writing why they're doing so. Moving on, page 14, line 15, there are provisions for fuel supplies. And one, this is an area where there were changes made to the last work draft, and the provisions dealing with producing oil or gas has been removed. What used to be subsection B was removed from this draft.
And then, Brian, what about subsection A, direct ownership of transportation and storage facilities, is that still in the bill? Was that removed in the other CS?
Madam Co-Chair, page 14, lines 17 through 18 still includes that language.
Okay. Can you explain to me what scenario you would see where GRETC would have direct ownership and transportation and storage facilities? Are we talking fuel tanks? Are we talking, I guess I'm looking for a definition here.
Madam Co-Chair. A transportation facility would be something akin to a pipeline or something that could move a fuel source, and a storage could be a variety of means to store a fuel source.
Gas storage?
There is nothing in this, Madam Co-Chair, there's nothing in this language that would limit it.
Okay, thank you.
Page 14, line 22, the tax exemption provision. This is a provision that's intended to maintain a tax-neutral stance towards local governments. The municipality public utilities are exempt from taxes because they're governmental entities. Cooperatives are exempt from taxes, local property taxes, by statute. They instead pay a electric cooperative tax on retail sales of electricity. What this provision provides is that the corporation would be exempt unless they sell electricity at retail. So taking the scenario that it sells power at wholesale to a cooperative, the cooperative would sell through their distribution to their retail customers, the cooperative will pay the cooperative tax. That's basically a tax that's paid to the state and then reimbursed to local government, so it becomes in effect a payment in lieu of taxes type situation. By having the corporation pay the cooperative tax on retail sales, it's tax neutral to the local governments because the corporation could not sell at retail and take away a cooperative tax that otherwise would be passing through to local governments.
Madam Co-Chair.
Representative Edgman.
You talked a little bit about severance tax or royalty tax or how those taxes would be factored into that provision.
Mr. Co-Chair, this is a provision that is currently applicable to cooperatives, electric cooperatives in Alaska. And I don't know how that provision might apply to those types of taxes in to a cooperative that has the same type of scenario. So I can't speak to that at this point.
So likely, Madam Co-Chair, that's something that probably would need to be reviewed and addressed maybe at a later time.
Yeah. Madam Chair, any questions?
Representative Johansson.
Before we get too far from page 13, and I don't know who can answer this, maybe you or utilities, because it might be a function of timing, et cetera, but on the long range, fuel supply, capital improvement, financial management plan, it says under B on each section, the board shall establish a schedule for review at least once every 5 years. And so I'm not sure who to ask, but I'll throw it out there and maybe someone can answer later. But I guess conceivably this could pass and we wouldn't see any of those plans for 5 years, or is it the intent to have those done immediately, or would it take more time? I don't know. Somebody out there in the audience, when they testify at some point, maybe can touch on that. I don't know if it's structurally, it looks like they wouldn't have to be given to us for 5 years, and is that okay or not? But just read by the letter of the law, if they have 5 years to get all of these plans out to the public and to the legislature. Is that correct?
Through the co-chair, Representative Johansson, I don't believe that that is what the bill provides, and I don't believe it's the intent. What the reference is to establish a schedule for reviewing the long-range fuel supply plan in that instance and update the plan at least once every 5 years. If you go to subsection A, there is a provision that the corporation shall adopt a long-range fuel supply plan. And what subsection B is doing is to reviewing an existing plan and updating it, and the update has to be at least every 5 years. Now, there's not a time frame for the initial plan to be adopted, but the mandate is there from day one, and without a specific time deadline, you would read into the statute within a reasonable period of time, which may be different for different of these plans, because some may be more reasonable to have put in place quicker than others, but the subsection B dealing with review and updating every 5 years, that's not intended, and I don't read it as applying to the initial mandate to provide each of those plans.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Brian, I'm assuming that the reason that they're doing this is for review of the public and the legislature. It doesn't say who's reviewing it, but I would imagine that it would be the people that they're getting their money from, which would be the state, and then the people they're serving, which would be the consumers.
Madam Co-Chair, the review is reviewed by the board, and the board reviews the plan and updates the plan, and then once the plan is updated, then there's an obligation to make it available to the governor, the legislature, ratepayers, and members.
Every 5 years?
At least every 5 years. And the board is supposed to establish a schedule for review, and the schedule for review may be different for different plans also. It may make more sense for it to be updated more frequently than 5 years on some of the plans and extend out closer to 5 years on other plans. And in addition to this being useful to the members, governor, legislature, and ratepayers, it's also very useful to the corporation. This is their planning, their ability to make sure that they're capable of providing generation transmission needs for the utilities in the rail belt.
And Brian, what other state entities have a review like this in a long-range fiscal financial management plan that comes to the legislature? And are those, is that, I imagine the railroad, the permanent fund, some of the other subsidiaries of the state have these reports. I mean, I think we get reports yearly from some of those through the legislature.
Madam Co-Chair, I'm aware of several public corporations that have an obligation to provide annual reports, but I want to make the point that this is a private corporation. It is going to be not a state corporation, but a private corporation. And the reason that there are reports being given by the private corporation goes back to one of the primary purposes. This is a vehicle for the utilities to come to the state for state financial assistance. Recognizing that's what's going to be the case, these obligations to do regional planning and provide information, it's going to be useful to the legislature when they provide oversight and deal with funding requests or other state financial assistance that the utilities will be collectively requesting through the corporation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johansson.
I'm just thinking it's getting late and I'm getting a little goofy, but if the corporation sold tickets to watching this process, they could probably fund a couple of their projects, because that's got to be a pretty interesting process to watch all these folks get together and put together a 10-year capital improvement plan. I'd love to sit and watch it. It must be fascinating. $20 a head, pay-per-view, you could make a lot of money probably.
Well, Brian, I guess, you know, if they're a private company, but they're coming outside of their private company to the state for funding, why wouldn't we have an annual review of somebody that we're giving money to every year to fund projects, or maybe every 3 or 4 years? Why would the legislature or the governor approve a plan if they only get to see it every 5 years? And why wouldn't we want to keep tabs on how our money's doing and how we're doing for the consumers? I don't think every 5 years is. I mean, if they weren't coming with their hand out to the state or trying to get their hands on the rail belt energy money, I wouldn't have a problem with it if it was private money. But it's not private money. It's, although it's a private corporation funded by a state entity. I don't know. Maybe I'm just tired.
Madam Co-Chair, if you look at page 15, line 28, there are provisions for audits and examinations of the corporation. It's to be annually audited, and the corporation shall submit copies of each report to the legislature and the governor within 30 days of receipt by the corporation. In addition to that, on page 14, line 27, there is a provision for reports and publications. The board of the corporation is required to publish an annual report on the internet. The annual report, I'll just point out, on lines 30 through 31, the annual report must include, quote, any other information requested by the legislature. And so the annual report that you're going to get on what the corporation is doing is going to be coming from those sections. And if there's any information the legislature wants from the corporation on anything the corporation is doing, all it has to do is request it, and it will have to be included within the annual report.
Okay.
Madam Chair, just on that
Representative
point.
Johansson.
I don't want to belabor this because I'm not sure how important it is, but requested by the legislature, formally requested, or can Chris just write you a letter and it has to be in there? Because, you know, I mean, is the request a formal request? Is it from the speaker? Is it a resolution? Is it could you get 50 requests and then the corporation spends half its time trying to answer letters from people like me, which probably don't really.
Through the co-chair, Representative Johansson, the request from the legislature, I believe, is intended to be from the legislature, not from individual legislators. It does not say individual legislators. That could be by a resolution. It would not be through an enactment of a statute or something of that nature.
Thank you.
So,
Representative Edgemond?
And I've probably fallen out of step here, stepping out of the meeting for a second, but what's the logic behind having anticipated capital improvements planned during each of the following 10 years? Or what led to the development of that language, and why 10 years? And I'm sorry, this is 13, line 17.
The long-range capital improvement plan is intended for what is the corporation going to be doing long-term, looking long-term into the future, because capital projects take a very long time to develop. Mm-hmm. And so looking forward at least 10 years, as is required in this plan, will force the corporation to look at all of the alternatives and make some decisions early on so that it can start planning. The long-range capital improvement plan ties in then to the long-range financial management plan, because once you decide what you want to build, then you have to start planning how are you going to finance it. And so that's the gist of it. And 10 years is just looking at what are the needs of the rail belt utilities under GRETC, and looking that far ahead is probably necessary in order to be able to fulfill those needs.
So this is a product then of the six utilities getting together and deciding that this was important to the legislation?
Through Mr. Co-Chair, yes. This is a part of the bill that flows out of the task force and was out of the task force process.
Mm-hmm. Representative Edgemond?
Playfully after we have
our name. No.
Fine. Moving on to page 18, I'm just going to go through the rates for line 20, rates for electric power, energy, and services. And the basic process that's set up for establishing rates, again, this is a section that will take effect in 2015. The process includes or requires a notice, which must include a statement of the justifications and reasons supporting a rate. The notice must be published in a manner to reasonably inform members and ratepayers. The deadline for comments can't be less than 30 days. The corporation has to hold one or more hearings. The corporation must have a written decision, which includes full and complete justification supporting the final rates and charges. And then members may appeal a decision under the dispute resolution provision of the bill. And that's AS 4250-220. Which is page 16, line 8. And that basically provides that a dispute initially will be brought to the board. There's mandatory mediation. The bylaws can provide for arbitration, so it's optional. And if it's not resolved otherwise, then litigation is the means for resolving.
So, Brian, why wouldn't the RCA come in during that rate-making period? Is that because we've exempted the RCA after 5 years, or where does the RCA? Why would it go from being mediated internally in the GRETC Corporation straight to litigation?
Madam Co-Chair, there's an intermediate step, the option of arbitration, and this is the corporation's internal dispute resolution mechanism, which will be fleshed out in the bylaws. The more detail will be provided to it. The provisions dealing with the rates, rate setting, that takes place in 2015 after RCA is no longer involved with the rate setting process. And so the corporation for the first 5 years will have to follow all the RCA rules. The rate setting provisions apply after that no longer takes effect. Now, the internal dispute processes take effect immediately because there can be other types of disputes that have nothing to do with rates or RCA or anything else. There's just an internal dispute resolution process.
Okay.
Page 21, line starting on line 3, there's a section that basically just authorizes the Alaska Energy Authority to contract with an energy and transmission corporation to operate or maintain a power project. And so this is a tool that will be used by the Alaska Energy Authority to allow the Gretzky Corporation, when it's formed, to take a role in operating and maintaining both the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project and the Alaska Intertie. Sections 13 and 14 I went through earlier, so I won't repeat that. And the balance of the bill are the effective date provisions. So that completes my run-through of the various sections.
Is there any questions? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at, you made a statement earlier when we were talking about the five-year review. Go back to that real quick. Page 13, the long-range capital improvement plan combined with the long-range financial management plan. And we should have a long-range capital improvement plan, but then we only plan on having RCA do any regulations for 5 years. So what projects can we see happening in the next 5 years that would need some sort of regulation rates by RCA?
Through the co-chair, Representative Tuck, the planning function is different than the implementation function. The planning function, and looking out 10 years, is to make sure that the corporation is on top of what the needs in the future are going to be and start planning for it. And that should be done, you know, starting pretty much immediately when the corporation is established, so that they can start looking forward to what those needs in the future are going to be. A separate question are, what are the immediate needs of generation and transmission? And those aren't going to be, the planning isn't necessary in looking out 10 years. Doesn't mean that you can't implement and develop a project more quickly than that, particularly if there is something that is needed. And that will be operating on its own time frame, and the utilities are probably better capable than I am at this point to give you examples of what they're thinking about today as far as what the more immediate projects might be. But the planning functioning looking out 10 years is not intended to limit the corporation from more immediately implementing whatever is necessary from developing projects.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. It states in here that at least four members are needed to create this corporation. And what you talked about earlier, there are methods allowed in here for them to withdraw. What if enough or people who've joined withdraw and you end up with less than four once the thing is already been established? Is it allowed to go forward?
Through the co-chair, Representative Peterson, yes. And that is because the organization of the corporation requires four or more utilities. Once the corporation is organized, then it continues in existence. And it doesn't lose the ability to exist after it's been organized.
Okay. Just want to get that on the record.
Okay. Is there any other questions? Okay, I think we'll just keep you in the audience, though, because I know there will be more questions. And although the utilities had all summer to go over this, I know we're trying to get through this in a timely manner, but it's going to take a long time, I think, for our committee members to digest some of the things. There's a few members that have followed the task force as they've gone forward in developing this, but not everybody was at every meeting, and so we have a lot of questions, and I think it's normal to vet those on the committee level rather than when we get it up to finance. I think that that's unfair, that we should probably do some of the work here. So that's why we have so many questions. Not because we don't like the bill, it's because it's a huge bill, and it's an incredible concept, and I think we're all very supportive of the utilities doing this. But it's a manner in which the utilities have come together and found a common ground. Now we just need the legislature to come in and find that same common ground, or adjust it to where they're comfortable with it. And I think think we'll be able to do that in this committee. So with that, we will start. It is 4:25. We will try and take as much public testimony as we can, and then I was speaking with the co-chair, and I think what we'll do, because I know we have a lot of utilities in town, is we'll recess to the call of the chair and look for an opportunity sometime tomorrow to get through the utility testimony, because I think it's important to get this bill moving. It's, you know, we have 20 days left in the session, and I don't want to be the committee that stymies the bill, so I'd like to vet all of our issues with the bill and then move it on. It has an additional referral to Labor and Commerce and Finance, so I think it's important that we continue the process, and I'll work with all the members to make sure that we can find some time that we can all get together. But I want to give the utilities an ample opportunity to make their case. So with that, I think we'll just move right into the utility testimony, and there's someone from Chugach. Okay, Janet.
Hi.
Hi, Janet. Thanks for your patience. And
no problem.
Just state your name. And what we'd like to do is we wanted to give the utilities about 10 minutes each to testify. I don't know if you'll need all that time, but I think that's a good question and period, because I think there is a lot of design questions on how the bill got to this point. So, Janet.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair, and Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate being in front of you today, and I would like to express, as a Chugach Electric Board member, our unqualified support for this bill. As you know, Chugach is the largest electric generating entity in the state. And I don't want to take all your time. I know you've got a lot of work to do, but I just want to talk a little bit as a utility board member, my perspective on that, and to appreciate, and I wish we'd had the selling tickets concept earlier. We could have sold tickets to the process that got us here.
Janet, can I just have you put your name officially on the record
and
your affiliation?
Janet Reiser.
Okay. And you're a board member of?
And I'm a board member of Chugach Electric Association.
Thank you.
So what I really want to emphasize is the unprecedented nature of the coming together to form this among the utilities. It has been an amazing feat, and I'm really proud of the process, and I would hope that, and the state's been involved in the whole time, and I would appreciate your strong support for this as well. I don't want to belabor the point, but I think it's really important to understand why the utilities have come together on this. We're certainly very much interested in the ratepayer and the ratepayer situation, gas supply, you know, electric generation throughout the rail belt, and that we are very interested in taking advantage of the economies of scale, as well as the reduced regulatory risk that we have, that we feel like we have under the GRETC. Also, it falls right in line with the REGA study, as well as the integrated resource plan that that we follow very, very diligently. So with just that said, I would really urge your strong support of this, and note that it is a very, very long and arduous process that we got to as utilities to get to this point, and certainly I appreciate the work of all of the utilities and the task force to get us where we are today in front of you. So,
thank you. Are there any questions?
Brief about that.
For Janet, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know it's been a long haul putting this all together, and you've been working closely with other utilities. Within the next 5 years, what projects do you see being put in practice right away that you can see happening within the next 5 years?
Well, certainly there are lots of opportunities. I think there are a lot of opportunities on renewable energy projects. I think there are some opportunities potentially in gas storage projects. I think certainly some combined generation, gas generation type projects. You know, we are doing this SPP project right now. That's a potential project to put in the GRETC corporation when it's formed. You know, there are a variety of things that I think that this will lend itself for. A lot of the big ticket projects we can't do on our own. Even as Chugach, the largest utility, we really need the support of not only the other utilities but the state. We're too small. We're too small on our own to really do this.
Madam Chair,
and how soon do you think this corporation can be up and running and actually be considering projects?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I believe that there's a lot of work to do just setting up the corporation, and I know that other work has been done to develop the timeline, but I don't know exactly what people are thinking. there. I think some of the other folks that will testify will have a better idea of exactly that, the timeline for that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Edgman?
We have a bill that may pass the session, House Bill 369, I think it is, that will set up a gas line project team, would require a plan back to the legislature by the end of July, and basically have, if I recall the details correctly, a project in gas line project sort of in motion by 2015. But can the state of Alaska pursue a gas line with the amount of investment it's going to take, probably by the state treasury, and have this very large entity called Gretzky out there pursuing other big ticket projects as well?
Well, thank you for your question, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm not an expert on that, so I couldn't tell you how that the state's effort to pursue a pipeline project of its own and Gretzky entity. You know, I'm not an expert on that, so I can't really respond directly to that. I do believe, though, that Gretzky has the opportunity to bring all the utilities together for common planning and common transmission. I mean, just that issue alone is a huge issue for the Gretzky type of an establishment to work on. So I don't think they're mutually exclusive at all, if that's what your question. Did I get your question correct?
So in other words, the formation of Gretzky would be important in terms of other strategic interests outside of securing a long-term energy source.
Absolutely. I think transmission is one that comes to mind right away.
Other questions? Jana, I just have just two questions for you. One, how would Tugatch feel about having the sunset for the RCA oversight to go away and it to be continually have oversight like the...
Well, I don't have a resolution from the board, but my general feeling is that is not a stop, that's not a stop issue for Tugatch.
It's not a must-have.
Not a must-have.
Okay. That's
you know, again, I don't have a resolution from the board, but that's my general feeling.
That's fine. And the other question I have is, as you can see, a lot of the discussion went on about gas storage and fuel supply and transmission via pipeline and the utility, the corporation owning basically an oil and gas company. How does Tugatch feel about that? I know it's modeled after the Bradley Lake and some of the other things that we've done, but how does Tugatch feel about getting in the oil and gas business?
I don't think there has been no discussion at the board level about getting into the oil and gas business. So that has not been on our radar, nor has that been discussed, to my knowledge. So that is not the position the board has taken at all.
So if those provisions were removed from Gretzky, Tugatch would still be on board with the legislation?
Again, I don't have a resolution to that fact, but my inclination is to say that we would not have a problem with that.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Janet while she's here? Thank you for your patience on. I know we've tried to get you guys to testify a couple times, and it's just
I appreciate your time, and I'm enjoying the whole process. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Janet. Appreciate it. Joe Griffith.
Madam Chair, with the indulgence of the committee, I'd like to bring my three board members that are here with me up at the same time. That would speed the whole process. If we could just have them come up here as well.
Absolutely, Joe.
Thank you. And we'll guarantee it'll be a short few words, and we'll be out of your hair, and that list will be a lot shorter.
And then just to start out, just so you know, when you speak, you'll just have to put your name and your affiliation on the record because we have someone transcribing our minutes for us, and so...
We'll certainly do that. thank you, Madam Co-Chair. My name is Joe Griffith. I'm the General Manager of Matanuska Electric Association. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you today about our favorite bill and to solicit your support in moving it out of your committee and on to what we hope will be a successful effort through a couple more committees and then to the floor. This is a crucial bill for the rail belt. If I may be completely frank with you, if we don't come up with something of, we collectively, the utilities, with something of this ilk, chances are we're going to face some very, very difficult times in providing what is the very lubricant that makes our economy work. and it's the electrical industry. And if you ever have any question about that, of course, just look around at what electricity does for us. 10 years ago, we should have started on this. We talked about it a lot for the last 10 years, and now we're at that point that we're hanging on to the end of a very short rope going over the falls, and we have to figure a new gas supply, new generation. We need to fix our transmission system, and the way we do that is by collective effort. And this is the first time you've seen all six utilities marching together in lockstep. I think we can pull it off in rather short order, but we need this legislation to make that happen. And I would request that you pass the bill as we have talked about it and as the governor has submitted it to you. And I'd like to ask several of my board members just to say a few words, if I might, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have. They also may have answers. And if it's technical issues, I'll be glad to answer those too.
Joe, I just want to ask you the two questions that I asked you, Getch. One was on the RCA oversight. Is that a game killer for you on continuing RCA oversight through the life of the Gretzky Corporation?
We see no reason for multiple layers of regulation. The list of regulation goes on and on. If you have public debt, it's SEC, it's Sarbanes-Oxley. You have all of the legislation requirements that Brian read to you. If you add another layer on there, you add cost and delay. And why is that necessary is the question I would ask. I think there's plenty of regulation. We rolled over to the five-year agreement because the governor's office had requested that. It makes sense to me to try it. And then you sunset it, and if the next legislature 5 years from now says these guys are a bunch of turkeys and they can't run this organization, we'll let the regulation stay forever. And every legislature, recall, has that right. I think sunset clauses are a good thing in laws. They make you stop and think about what you're doing. So I like the five-year thing.
With that being said, one of the reasons that we've been looking, and the folks on my committee that I've spoken with that are uncomfortable with that five-year limit on RCA, is that they won't be regulating anything until the sixth year. So it seems
that's not entirely true, Madam Co-Chair. You're looking at a lot of projects that could end up quickly in Gretzky. There's huge transmission needs. Any of those could be in the regulated environment. I can think of probably five or six major transmission projects that could be kicked off soon if we just had a little seed money on them. We're proposing to build a power plant. Chugach is building a new power plant. MLNP is talking about building a power plant, and so is Homer. That's a lot of generation, and all of that's got to get sorted out on how we proceed. Are we all going to build power plants? I have two concurrent economic dispatch studies underway as we speak. We're that concerned about, are we doing the right thing? And my big fear is that we won't do the right thing by not coordinating. And I'm not sure that there isn't going to be plenty of business in the generation and transmission side of the industry in the future for the RCA.
So I'll go back to my original question. Is it a game killer for MEA to remove that sunset?
No, we would not pull out. We would just be unhappy with it.
We don't want you unhappy. My second question to the other utilities, and then I'll get to Representative Johansson, is are you interested in Gretzky being a oil and gas company?
I don't think the suggestion ever was that we would become an oil and gas company. What we do need is the authority to get the fuels you need in any way, shape, or form, be that importation of liquid natural gas, perhaps fostering drilling in appropriate areas, perhaps owning gas in the ground, perhaps leasing tracts if there isn't enough activity. It's something to motivate the activity. I don't think we want to be an oil and gas company. No, we're not. We're an electric business. But unfortunately, our whole business hinges on whether or not you got that fuel.
We have been trying to incentivize the development of Cook Inlet, and if Gretzky can do it better than the state can, I'm all for it, because we have sure had a heck of a time. Representative Johansson.
Thank you. I had three questions. First of all, I'm a little confused because I don't keep track of everything that goes on up north, but didn't you testify in front of me in the last year for somebody else in this group? I just don't keep track.
I could have. I have been a consultant in the energy business. Okay. I don't, frankly,
I don't
remember it, but I could have.
Okay.
And if I did, I hope it was well done.
Of course. But you're with MEA recently, is that correct?
I went to work with MEA in July of this year.
That's probably it. You mentioned, when we talked about oversight, you mentioned the SEC, and then you mentioned a couple more, and I didn't quite get what they were. Oxley-Mobley, or what was that? I don't know what the heck it was.
Sarbanes-Oxley. If you have public debt and you're a private entity, you fall under the rules of the Sarbanes-Oxley law, and it's rather comprehensive, and it's rather thick, and if you haven't read it, I would find a good good descriptor of what the law is. It doesn't allow for many shenanigans.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to read that document. If I could follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
These two processes, SEC obviously must be Securities Exchange, Sarbanes-Oxley, is that a
federal law, sir?
So in order to approach this entity without RCA oversight, you would go to either one of two federal processes, is that correct?
Irrespective of whether you're state regulated, if you hold public debt, you will be under the Securities and Exchange Commission, and you would be a subject to the Sarbanes-Oxley law. That principally governs the board of directors and how they operate and what's required of a board.
Mr. Chairman, if I may follow up. And your average ratepayer knows about SEC and Sarbanes-Oxley. Do they know that's the people to go to if they have a problem?
My ratepayers probably do not, because we don't have public debt. When I was at Chugach, most assuredly, we attempted to explain to them the implications of SEC regulation, and that meant a 10-Q every quarter, a 10-K at the end of the year, and periodic reports as they might be applicable. You also have the generally accepted accounting principles, and if you're still holding RUS debt or REA debt, you fall under their rules and regulations. So there are a huge number of rules that we have to live by no matter what.
Right. Okay. And then switching gears, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Representative Johansson.
You mentioned quite a few projects that the words you used were quickly get these projects online. We'd like to do these things soon. Things you're excited about getting going for the good of the corporation. How does that fit inside this long-range capital improvement plan? Would you have to go through this process and get the Gretzky Corporation on board in order to quickly move to those projects, or are they projects that are more dear to MEA and you would, I'm just not sure the timing, would you have to go through this long-range plan first before the corporation could say, yes, we agree that the things you want to do quickly are things that the corporation agrees with? How do you feel about that?
Representative Johansson, through the chair, my recommendation to the board of directors, and I presume at this stage of the game I would sit on that board, would be that we would immediately conduct the planning processes required. We would need a long-range financial plan, the long-range capital improvement plan. You need a budget. You need all of those things in front of you so that everybody understands how the cow ate the cabbage, if you will. So we understand clearly what we're going to do and how we're going to get there. And there are crucial steps in that. In all likelihood, we will be looking at public debt. That means going to rating agencies. And you need business plans and long-range plans before you can even step in their door. So I would imagine one of the first things out of the chute
to be accomplished as fast as we could put it together would be to construct those plans. And they might be nothing more than simply outlines to start it, and then we just flesh it out as time progressed.
And finally, Mr. Chairman, if I might just
go. Representative Hanson.
Sure. I guess this gets down to my real, I don't want to be too much of a pessimist, but it all boils down again to the same entities agreeing on what we should do next. And so you're confident that because now we're calling this Gretzky and we put a little extra paint and put a flower in its hair, that it's going to make a difference, that we're going to be able to get all of these entities together and say quickly, yes, this is the project that we need to do first for the good of everybody. I mean, really, is this environment change going to help the natural kind of tendencies for these six folks to kind of rub up against each other?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Johansson, I believe it is the only course of action that we have today. If we don't undertake this, then I can't imagine how we're going to deal with future requirements that we face individually. It's a daunting task. It's daunting enough with all of us pulling together. So it's not my favorite projects. It's what I think is for the good of the rail belt and the good for the Alaska economy and our membership.
Thank you very much.
It's like dealing with the Senate.
It's like dealing with, yeah.
Thank you, Joe. Is there any other questions for Joe?
Madam Co-Chair, I would like to ask each one of my board members that are here today to say a few words to you, if you would have the indulgence.
Absolutely. We are happy that they are all here. It's an important issue. Take your time.
Okay. Go ahead, Chair.
Ms. Hurley.
Check this chair, Katie. Sit here in the hot seat.
Good to see you.
My name is Katie Hurley, and I'm a member of the MEA board of almost 3 years. I think that Joe already said this, but I want to repeat it. This is the first time the rail belt utilities are in agreement since Bradley Lake in 1986, which is 25 years ago. The utilities face a crisis in coping with the future. New generation intertie fuel supplies are required. We need Gretzky to coordinate all parties, utilities, the state, fuel supplies. MEA supports this bill that the governor has sent down, and I'm not sure whether it's a committee substitute yet or just where it is. And we hope that you will consider it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for all your service to the state and for your testimony. Are there any questions for Mrs. Hurley? No? Okay.
Good. I'm Kit Jones, and I'm on the MEA board. And again, thank you for letting us be here. I have only been on the board about a year and a half. And one of the reasons that I was elected, because people kept telling me the rail belt needs to work together. It had never worked together before. And I truly believe, because that was what I promised the people I would try to do, not that I did this, but that was what most of our majority of our ratepayers wanted to see done. I think it's monumental that it has gotten done. And then I have to give our general manager credit, because one of the other things that I was kind of mandated to do by the ratepayers was to change management. And we have, and we are delighted to have Joe, and he is a great leader. So again, the rail belt utilities have worked tremendously hard. And again, it would have been a show because we certainly don't all agree. I would like for the general manager to speak to the regional IRP, because I think that's going to give us direction right at first. And I guess you all are familiar with that. If not, you can direct your questions to the general manager.
We have had extensive review of the IRP and the IRP process. The AEA has been very good, and we've had Jay's favorite company come in and talk about the IRP. So we, this committee is fully aware of the IRP and the IRP process. So
great, thank you, Matt.
We don't want to.
I would like to introduce Larry DeVilbiss, also a board member of mine, Matt.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm sorry I didn't bring any carrots today. But I'm not a carrot farmer today. I'm a 7-year member of the board, and I would like to make the point that not only is the rail belt united on this, 3/4 of the population of the state of Alaska represented, but the MEA board is united on this. And if you know anything about the dynamics of our board, that's saying a lot. We're drifting into a perfect storm. And when you consider the gas supply and its uncertainties, when you consider the depreciation of our infrastructure that needs to be replaced, and when you put that together with what the RIRP brought out, our cumulative financing ability without the state is not sufficient to keep the lights on for the next 20 years. So if we don't take this step with GRETSI now, I don't think we're going to come out of the storm with everybody still floating. And I've heard some comments in this building today that this needs to mature. We'll deal with it next session. I don't think we've got the time to do that. We're looking at gas shortages that are going to happen before 2015, which is when we've got to start generating our own power. And it'll happen a lot better if we're working together and not everybody doing their own thing. And that's my comments. And I would like to say too that not only did the task force work on this substitute bill all through the summer and most of the winter, those of us that weren't on the task force were invited and were involved in a lot of the meetings. And so this has not been a dark smoke room filled deal that's been done.
Thank you, Larry. Is there anybody have any questions for Larry before he leaves? And I will say, Larry, we did both Representative Edgeman and my staff spent their summer at the GRETSI task force. And so while we attended a couple of the meetings, our staff was continually telling us on the process and sometimes roadblocks and how they made their way through. So we've appreciated the process that the task force has gone through also. I think it's been a very open and good dialogue and open to the public too, which I thought was great. Any more questions for MEA? Great. Is there any other utilities online, HEA, MLMP, GVA, that wanted to testify? No? Okay. Okay, with that, we will continue.
Madam Chair, just my name is Mark Johnson. I'm the General Counsel of Chugach, and I just wanted to make an offer. Yesterday, I made a presentation at the request of the Senate Resources Committee regarding regulation, and I have some background in that. I served on the RCA from 2003 to 2009. The presentation takes about 13 minutes, and it's designed to sort of expose what the regulation is and how it best applies to GRETSI, and I just wanted to make an offer. My board chair offered my services to the other body to make that presentation. I did, and I just wanted to reiterate that offer should it fit in the committee schedule. So I'm here through Thursday, and I am actually making the same presentation tomorrow at the RCA's public meeting in Anchorage. I'll do that telephonically, but I would be available should the committee desire to explore that question a little further.
Thank you, Mark. And I think we have actually our next testifier is the RCA chairman, so we'll if we have any more questions, and I think if that's what the committee wants to do, we can find some time to get with you and let you make that presentation to us. So I appreciate that. With that, I will go to Bob Pickett. Are you online, Mr. Pickett?
Yes, Chair Millett. This is Bob Pickett, Chairman of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And with me, can you hear me okay?
Yep, we can hear you perfectly. Thank you, Bob.
Okay. With me is Stuart Gehring from the Department of Law. I'm going to turn it down. I'm getting a little bit of feedback here.
Okay.
I do want to acknowledge the hard work of the Utility Task Force and the Alaska Energy Authority. It's been a long haul. They've done a lot of great work, and it is very encouraging to see the cooperation and working together. I do need to make a disclosure. What you're about to hear are my personal observations and my observations alone. At this point in time, it's not the position of the RCA, but I think it does reflect some of the thoughts of the various commissioners. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, we will have an emergency public meeting concerning specifically the Gretzky legislation. We had a regular meeting scheduled for the morning, but by the time the agenda had gone out, the new committee substitute had been posted, and we had not had an opportunity to really review that. Chair Millett, can you still hear me?
I can.
Perfectly. Okay. I think it's fair to say, and we did state this in a letter that was directed to Senator Stevens last year and to Speaker Chenault when the original legislation was introduced, that the RCA does strongly support the broad goals of GRETSI. We understand the benefits that come from cooperation, joint planning, lack of duplication, all of these types of things. But I think it's also fair to say that we also believe that protection of the public interest and the protection of the ratepayers must be at the heart of any legislation passed. Now, just to make sure that I am looking at the correct version, the one I have is the Chenoweth Bailey, dated 3/24/10, 26GS1041/S. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Section 3 has been held out as being this interim form of traditional regulation in the period of time that in the current working draft is proposed for the RCA. My observation is the language of this Section 3, which is found on pages 2 and 3, is dramatically different from traditional rate regulation, and in fact, does more closely resemble an exemption than regulation. And I'll just hit upon a couple of areas here. You know, in traditional rate making, operating expense recovery is based on historic cost base with known and measurable adjustments. You know, the rate of return and depreciation are set to provide funds for system expansion, capital repairs, overhaul, and replacement. And the resulting rates have to be just and reasonable. The deviations you see in Section 3, and I have a whole list of them, I'm not going to go through line by line. We will provide the outcome of our public meeting in a written form to the committee for your consideration and evaluation at the conclusion of our meeting tomorrow. But in general, the deviations are this. The operating expense recovery is based on management representations or anticipation about future operations. And, you know, you can see that language towards the bottom of page 2 there. You know, the capital is accumulated as an end in itself, with the amounts collected in any particular period determined by an unspecified relationship to future needs. You know, and at least some individual cost elements are conclusively presumed to be just and reasonable, with really no guidance as to how resulting rates will be evaluated, if at all. So if it is the intent of the legislature to have this section remain in this bill, we will most definitely need some strong legislative clarification as to what it actually means and what it is specifically you're asking the RCA to do, because this has nothing to do with the traditional rate-making process. Most of my comments, and I did appear before the Senate Resources Committee yesterday afternoon, focused on this Section 3, and tomorrow we will be going through the bill in its entirety and hopefully offering some constructive comments for consideration of the committee. And there are a number of other policy and technical questions that have, you know, arisen in my brief review of the remainder of the bill. It was earlier in the testimony this afternoon, it was stated that there's already plenty of protection for the ratepayer. You have Sarbanes-Oxley. You have the SEC requirements if you do go out for, you know, some sort of public exposure. And there's, I think it's fair to say there is this underlying policy assumption throughout the bill that auditing equals regulation, or corporate governance equals regulation, or there are some federal forms of regulation that supplant the normal rate-making process. Again, keep in mind, I'm speaking for myself. I think nothing could be further from the truth. And you just need to be aware of, you know, some of the assumptions underlying these statements. I think it's fair to say the recent Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac financial debacles, they were subject to Sarbanes-Oxley. They were subject to the SEC filing requirements. They had a plethora of external auditors, and we all saw where this led. I would refer to the bottom of page 13 of the bill. I'll give you a moment to turn to that. And on lines 28 to 31, there is a reference made to the corporation, Gretzky, issuing equity and debt. I'm very unclear how this, what this actually means. How will Gretzky issue equity? I thought Gretzky was a not-for-profit. And, you know, I think it needs to be clarified. Is this some new form of patronage capital? Will there be some sort of return on equity through some mechanism? There are a number of other questions of this nature that we will be looking at tomorrow, and hopefully making some conclusive statement on the part of the Commission about our interpretation and request for clarification where we see there might be need for that. I've heard a number of times the citation of Bradley Lake, which is most definitely a true success story for the state involvement in projects of this type. And it's been a huge benefit to the Rail Belt utility ratepayers over time and will continue to be one. The implication is that this is some sort of a model that just by virtue of its success automatically is a firm endorsement of all of the provisions of this Gretzky bill. I think it's time for a bit of humility also. There's other examples of state-funded projects not having nearly the same level of success or involvement with projects that also have state, federal utility money. Healy Clean Coal is an example that does come to mind. And I think, finally, I'd make the observation that going forward, the biggest cost driver for the ratepayers is going to be on the generation and transmission side. This is where the capital investment is needed. This is the part of the electrical system that is going to be confronted with very challenging fossil fuel prices in the inlet here going forward. And it's going to become the driver for individual households' electric bills. I'm an MEA co-op member, and when I look at my bill, 70% of it is essentially attributable to G&T. Other co-ops and utilities have different percentages depending on their particular situation. But I think it's fair to say the G&T component is well over 50% in the Rail Belt, and it is headed probably substantially higher. So if the deregulation of the electrical utility system, the system as a whole, is actually one of the inherent main goals of Gretzky, I think that decision should be made transparently, out in the open, with all of the arguments, both sides out in the open, and with the ratepayers well aware of what's going on. There are currently provisions in our statutes in 4205 that provide for the deregulation elections of the co-ops, with, in all actuality, a pretty low standard. And I guess I would make the argument, if you want to deregulate, ask the ratepayers, make your case, and let them speak. With that, I do want to give thanks to the committee and to Chair Millett, and I'll be available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pickett. Are there questions for the Chair of the RCA? you, Bob. I don't think we have any questions at this time. Did Stuart want to offer any comments on Gretzky?
Chairman Millett, I thank you for the opportunity. I don't necessarily have any comments to make, but of course I am available for questions if the committee has any at this time.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And I think we'll take one more person on. I have Caitlin Higgins from Alaska Conservation Alliance, who has hung strong with us through this, and I want to give her an opportunity to testify. Also, in the members' packets, they did send a letter with some issues, and I think Caitlin will address those when she gives her testimony. Caitlin, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can. And just state your name and affiliation for the record and give us your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Caitlin Higgins, Executive Director of the Alaska Conservation Alliance. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify on the proposed Gretzky bill in front of you today. The Alliance and its 40 member organizations representing 38,000 Alaskans acknowledge the administration's work to find consensus on these issues and appreciate its efforts, as well as the positive initial steps taken by the Railbelt utilities. We also appreciate the legislators' work to consider the proposed entity. We encourage your continued consideration of the following principles so that we may ultimately support legislation to create a consolidated utility. Additionally, the HEA Members Forum, which is a ratepayers group based in Homer, who is not able to have a representative present for this hearing today, asked me to relay their support for the following testimony. Energy efficiency and demand-side management are clearly cost-effective, and as outlined in the Real in Alaska Roadmap, a central utility that plans and promotes energy efficiency could provide the Rail Belt with significant economic gains and job growth and assist efforts to better plan which generation projects are truly needed. As a result, we encourage that statutory language require a unified utility to evaluate and enact cost-effective conservation and demand-side measures in the development of its integrated resource plan. Additionally, renewable energy with a stable long-term price is the region's best long-term economic interest. We support ongoing regulatory and financial oversight of the proposed single large new entity. Such oversight should be mandated by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and should not sunset after 5 years of operation. This ongoing regulation ensures that individual ratepayers, businesses, and industry have access to reliable, safe utility services, an important component of what is and should continue to be required of any energy supplier. RCA regulation of a single entity maintains a system of checks and balances that we consider essential in the oversight of the proposed entity, and we encourage the revision of statutory language to address this issue. Ratepayers' voices are an essential aspect of utility governance, and we encourage that the board of directors of the new utility include a significant portion of citizen representation above the currently proposed single governor appointee. We will alternatively support a separate citizens utility board responsible for overseeing the utility's activities. Either of these options ensures fair representation of consumer voices in an entity that would contain great decision-making power affecting the lives of many ratepayers. We support the statutory language that has thus far maintained open meeting provisions and strongly encourage that language be added to ensure that public representation and or oversight is a meaningful part of any new entity. Thank you again to the committee for your focus on this issue and to those involved in drafting this language. Ultimately, we recognize that utility consolidation could provide many benefits for the Rail Belt region. We see that the legislature has an opportunity to create a regional entity that can be an effective organization to bring important energy improvements to reality. So that we might support the Gretzky proposal, we encourage this committee to consider including language to better address financial and regulatory oversight, governance and public input, and energy efficiency. We are committed to working with utilities, stakeholders, legislators, and the people of Alaska to collaborate on ways to address these concerns as we continue to support the ongoing efforts to create a new entity that will help meet our public electrical needs for coming generations. Again, thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Caitlin. Are there any questions for Caitlin? Seeing none, thank you, Caitlin. And that we will recess to the call of the chair with the understanding that at some point tomorrow we will get together with the committee members, find the appropriate time, and finish with our public testimony. And then on Thursday, work through adopting the CS, the amendments, and with the hope by Thursday afternoon, we can have it on to its next committee of referral would be our plan. So with that, we are recessed to the call of the chair.